Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dave Cormier in this episode. Dave is a rhizomatic learning enthusiast who sees online learning as giving opportunity for much more than instruction. He's an advocate of empowered learning. Information is no longer scarce, it's now very abundant. So Dave believes our education must reflect that. I'm talking with Dave Cormier, a systems change leader and educator based in Windsor, Canada. Dave is an enthusiastic advocate of what he terms rhizomatic learning and a total advocate of open education. He's a broad university experience and a computing history that goes all the way back to a Commodore VIC-20, the same computer I cut my own teeth on. Dave, it's great to be talking with you.
Oh, great to talk to you too. Go VIC-20.
Absolutely. 2.5K is enough for anyone.
Right.
Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
So I have a bit of an odd career. I'm what I like to think of as an alt academic. I don't fit into the regular boxes. I've never had an appointed faculty position. I work through the ranks inside of universities and in K-12 doing a variety of different tasks. So I've done everything from managing the web infrastructure of a university to writing an academic plan to doing academic strategy for K-12 for educational technology. So I've been in all the different bits and pieces. I've done recruitment, I've done retention, I've run analytics projects. And so for me, education is kind of a systems piece, and I'm always kind of looking at how the things that have been happening, and particularly the changes that have happened in the last 15 or 20 years, impact what it means to know, what it means to learn, and that's really where my writing comes from. The first published article that I ever had was in 2008. It was called Rhizomatic Education, Community as Curriculum, and it was an attempt to, really was a response to a challenge I got from George Siemens, who had said, look, you keep talking about this, but if you don't publish it, nobody's going to believe you. And so I made that first toe dip into trying to actually publish the stuff that I've been blogging about for years. And rhizomatic learning is really about thinking about the education experience as something that is actually student-centered, something that actually evolves as you go along, something that is not predetermined, something that grows out of the community of people that come together, that learn together. And it's really something that can only exist in an information-abundant society. So it is, to me, an expression of the changes that are happening to us right now. So if you look at what was possible 30 years ago, you really only had the things that came inside of people's heads who came to the room. You had the books that were nearby, maybe the library that was across the way, but really you were limited by that information scarcity. And our educational system developed accordingly. And when you look at things like andragogical theory from the late 60s and early 70s, they wanted to be student-centered, but there was an awful lot of things that still had to stay inside the power structure of the instructor in front of the room because they were the only people with access to information. And so it's really a nod towards the new capacities that we do have, and it's incumbent upon us to start teaching in different ways that actually allow us to develop the literacies that are going to help us in the 21st century. So that's really what rhizomatic education is about. That same year, I fortunately or unfortunately said the word MOOC in a conversation. I said, hey, this sounds like a massive open online course, and ended up being the person who coined the term MOOC, much to many people's chagrin and other people's careers. But it was an incidental conversation around the first so-called MOOC in 2008. And so the next big publication that you see, if you ever put my name in there, is the one that I did with George Siemens and Sandy McDonald and Bonnie Stewart called the MOOC Model for Digital Practice. And it's really the first serious piece of research that was done on MOOCs. It was in 2010 before the one at Stanford came out in 2011. And then from there, you see a variety of different pieces that come out. And to me personally, a MOOC is an extension of rhizomatic learning anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it isn't for everybody. And then from there, I dabbled a little bit in virtual worlds and got out of that business. And then the latest publication, for instance, that just came out was in the inaugural issue of post-digital education. And that's on the idea of post-digital education and how we need to look at our education system after the idea of digital being novel, but rather as it being integrated in sort of a deep way into the way that we're thinking.
So you coined the term. It's a pity you didn't trademark it at the time. You might be a very rich man by the stage.
Yeah, well, you know what? It didn't seem like a big deal at the time. We were just in a casual conversation and we just started using the word because we needed to call it something. And then Stanford runs a course and 165,000 people show up, and all of a sudden I get a phone call from the Wall Street Journal asking me my opinion on whether or not MOOCs are going to make money. The answer is no, by the way. It was no then, and it's no now. The answer is still no.
Right.
Don't want to spoil the ending on that one for everybody, but we said so then, and it's still true now. You can't give something away for free and make money from it. It just doesn't work.
So just on that then, I mean, I really want to explore this theme with you. You're obviously a systems thinker. You've thought very deeply and broadly about this, and you've presented on it multiple times over the years. Yeah. So what would a Rhizomatic learning system look like? How would it be funded? What are the dynamics? I wonder if you could just dream aloud for us here.
I think that when you look at the systems that we have, they are cultural systems. And because they're cultural systems, they're steeped in complexity. That being true, there is no changing that system. Mm. So you can't go at our education system and say, we're going to make it something different. You can say that all you want. There's no expectation that's actually going to happen. And it's the kind of system, I like to think of it as there's two nails driven into a table. And mostly what you do is pull the elastic tied between them. And as long as you're holding on to the elastic, you can make changes inside the system. But eventually you're going to let go. And it snaps back to the place where it originally began. Most of the big changes that have tried to go inside of our education system to me fall into that category. So for me, my goal is more a question of incremental change. So what I'm positing in my book are a series of different approaches that you can use to make small C change inside of your own classroom, like on an individual day, over time, the way you do assessment, the way we talk about connecting courses inside of a school, the way we run short courses, the way we do teacher training. It's really about a kind of 1% change towards us getting more ready to deal with complexity, to have our classrooms be about uncertainty rather than certainty. And that, to me, in a nutshell, is the change we need to make. We've inherited an education system that was built on the conception of certainty, which had some advantages in a knowledge scarcity economy. But now that we live in the world we're living in now, we're constantly confronted with uncertainty, looking for the certain rather than dealing with the complexity around us. That's, to me, the only approach to bring that into the classroom is change that little bit there, get somebody over there using a contract rating system, having somebody do genius hour inside their K-12 classroom.
Okay. So the teacher's role then clearly does change quite considerably. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It does, definitely. It's way more terrifying. You know, the number of teachers I've talked to over the years who say, I need to know everything before I walk into the classroom, right? I need to know, because if I don't know, I don't feel comfortable. That's gone. The trick is, though, and I think the realization that I try to help people with is that it's gone anyway. Whether you think it's gone or not, every kid in your classroom, not every kid, there's all kinds of people who don't have access to technology, but many children in your classroom, many university students in your classroom already have access to all the information in the world in their pocket. So there's no real being the expert in that sense anymore. Any argument you could ever make in any field, somebody could come up with another expert that's similarly educated as you are who has a different opinion. That's always been the truth of our fields, right? There's always been this difference in discourse and tension inside the fields. It's just now we can't hide it from our students anymore. You know, we're not the University of Paris anymore, where we have the only books in a 100-mile radius and people have to come to us. We just don't live in that world. So the teacher is no longer the person that everyone turns to. Hopefully, they turn to that person, but not for information, rather for, you know, leadership, for guidance, for their mores, for the approaches, for how to pull this stuff together. So in that sense, I think it really changes. Also, you know, when I teach my favorite class, Educational Technology and the Adult Learner, I would start with an empty curriculum, and I would sit down the first day and my students would say, hey, what do you need us to do so we can pass? And I would say, well, I don't know. I've just met you, so I don't know what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching teachers, so you can imagine the chaos that created, because they want to know what their objectives are. And I said, well, I don't know what your objectives are. That's like in an actual student-centered classroom, you would think the objectives would come from the students. And so that changes as well, right? So ideally, as a professional who is engaged in teaching, I'm engaged with my field anyway. So I should be constantly growing as an educator, but when I'm doing my classroom, I shouldn't be planning everything my students are going to do before I walk in. I mean, I'm not saying there's no plan. I'm just saying the planning process is less about collecting quote-unquote content and then doling it out week after week, but rather creating an environment that looks more like what a sexy five-day seminar looks like, which is, let's get to know each other. Okay, so let's figure out what you do. I mean, it's andragogy, really. We still haven't left Malcolm Knowles behind. And you sort of set it up. You get to know the people who are in there, and you guide them towards the things that they need to learn.
You make it sound really simple.
It's totally simple. It's terrifying, though. It's terrifying because you never, you don't have that, particularly if you give away the hammer of assessment, right? And this always comes down to assessment. It's always about assessment. So anytime, like I talked to a teacher this summer, he is a faculty member this summer at a university. And he's like, I'm quitting teaching. That's it. I can't do this anymore. And we just spent a half an hour talking, and I was mostly listening, about his passion for education. I was like, well, you're not the one we want to lose. You're the passionate one. Like, you're the one. You love your students. You can tell me not only the names of your students, but you can tell me what they wanted, right? Like, you're engaged in that classroom. And he says, well, it's the assessment that's killing me. Because how am I supposed to judge these people against each other when they're doing entirely different things?
Yeah.
What does it even mean to choose one above the other? Because that assumes that in my head, I know what perfection is, and I'm measuring how close all y'all are getting to perfection. Mm. We can say that out loud, but when you actually work your way through that thought, it's kind of a weird one. I mean, let's say you're teaching literature and you're getting people to write essays. What is a perfect essay, really? You know, I always think of that classic Rodney Dangerfield movie from the 80s where he hired J.D. Salinger to write an essay on J.D. Salinger and he got a D because he didn't understand what the author intended. And so for me, it's that idea of there being the perfect outcome that we're somehow grading people against. And we worked it through, he and I started talking to him about contract grading and saying, look, you can get around this and you can decide that what you're measuring in your classroom is effort, not perfection. And you were saying earlier that I may sound too simple. There's a lot of fights that happen inside of faculty meetings when this happens.
Yeah.
Right? Suddenly you become the person who says, okay, everybody's going to get to choose their final grade based on how much effort they make, and people's heads explode. The situational social stuff is always harder. And there's the whole process of deprogramming people as well, right? So students come in with an expectation of what it means to succeed in a classroom. And suddenly you say, yeah, you know what? All that stuff you spent the last 12,000 hours of your life learning, yeah, we don't do that anymore. So you get a lot of pushback from students as well, right?
Okay, so it sounds like a fundamental change to the entire system of education, which is very compelling. How do you think it would scale? Is this something that can be done right across K-12, right through formal education and the tertiary years? I'm just interested to learn a lot more about this vision. I'm hungry for more.
So I think you're always working in percentages, right? So I don't think there's a wholesale change that you're ever going to have inside any system. And I always think of the pushback I had inside of some discussions in K-12. I shouldn't say pushback. That makes it sound like I'm right and they're wrong. The very valid points that were made by others who were looking at the stuff I was doing, saying, look, we've got students going into university who are going to be sitting in classrooms of 400 people who are going to be doing multiple choice exams. If they never do a multiple choice exam in high school, they're going to be toast when they get there. Okay, fair enough. That's true. That's the system we currently live in. And I'm not saying we should never have a multiple choice exam. I'm not saying we should never do anything in a command and conquer way. So if I'm teaching my kid how to wash his hands, we're not having a philosophical conversation about whether or not he should. Just do it and do it every time. You know, it's not everything has to be rhizomatic. Some things are just command and control, and you just tell people to do it. But one of the courses that I was fortunate enough to participate in designing in K-12 was a computer science course, because I was told that I would never be able to do this in the sciences, and particularly not with technology. So being stubborn, I chose grade 11 computer science as the goal. So what my colleague and I, who's a fantastic guy in the K-12 system in Prince Edward Island, Mark Lamy, we worked through a design that made it so that in grade 11 computer science, we mostly weren't assessing the coding. What we were doing was assessing their social-emotional ability to work inside the classroom. and we were assessing their project management skills. On the project management side, it was complicated stuff. It was step by step. Could you organize it? Did you do it properly? Because again, strict organized project management is a great idea, right? Mm-hmm. And on the other side, we had a much softer piece that was about, because one of the things we'd identified in the classroom that was really frustrating to students was the noise, right? So we were doing Arduino, so we were doing microprocessor stuff.
Yeah.
And the noises were really disturbing to some students. So the first assignment that they had to write about was, how did I feel about the environment of the classroom? What are the things that I can do? Like, do I need to wear a headset? What do I need to do to be able to function inside of this work? And so all of the actual coding and building, we didn't grade it. So the first project was an elastic band launcher. Whether or not your elastic band launched or not was totally irrelevant. It's my job as a teacher to make you feel excited enough to finish your project, but that's not what I'm measuring. I'm measuring your project management, and I'm measuring your ability to reflect, right? Yeah. But what it means is the creative stream down the middle. The second project is building a mini putt. I don't know if that's the same expression you use, but a mini putt golf hole.
Yep.
So I don't care what you build, and I don't care if it works. I care if you work hard at it. But what you do is you protect the creativity from assessment. Right. And then what happens is what you're actually learning, what you actually do, the things you choose to go ahead and do, particularly by the third assignment, which is wide open. So you've got the gradual release model going on there where you've got more structured first project, a less structured second project, but the real Rhizomatic piece comes in third. Right. So you can embed this inside of the most sort of rigid of courses. And we often think of computer science as pretty step by step kind of piece. But you end up with a real heart of creativity in the middle of that and a real chance for kids to just work together and you know, heaven forbid, have fun doing it.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it. So the Rhizomatic concept then can be as big as an entire system, but it can also be an element of something within an existing system.
Absolutely.
That sounds really compelling. So Dave, obviously, when you look around online learning and education now, you don't see much of that. What are your observations about online education at the present time, coming up towards the end of 2019?
I think that the vast majority of the press around online learning is controlled by some major institutions. Mm. And I think those major institutions believe in mastery learning and think that's what learning is. And I think that's reflected in the pedagogy that we see coming out of those systems. So when you hear people talk about outsourcing, which happens so much in this, particularly in the States right now, but in different places where they're just outsourcing their online learning to outside organizations. Those organizations are not learning organizations. They're corporate organizations that are trying to get straight down to, you know, the most efficient way of running their business so that they can make money. I'm not saying they're doing a bad thing by doing that. Potentially choosing them was a bad thing, but that's not the business that they're in, right? The business they're in is in making money. And anytime you're interested in making money in education, the thing that you're counting is not the experience of the student, it's the money, right? Mm. And I think that's really reflected in the pedagogy that we see. Again, I'm not blaming people for wanting to make money. I'm just saying it often doesn't make for good learning. Because if you're in the business of proving to somebody that somebody has quote unquote learned, then you need to turn learning into something that can be counted. And I would say that you can't count learning at all. Like, I don't believe in that, that you can measure learning, like actual learning. So what you have to do is break the learning, quote unquote, process into something that's really simplistic so that you can measure it, which brings us back to things like multiple choice questions. Right. Not that people don't write really sexy multiple choice questions that are whatever, and they're validated testing processes and all the rest of this stuff. I won't use a expletive there like I was going to.
Yeah.
And I understand the need. Right? I understand the need to measure learning, but the need for something doesn't make it possible. Right? So my belief is that when we measure, quote unquote, what we're actually measuring is the education system, not the learning. Right? So what you're doing is measuring the model that you've created, which is a total artifice that lives on the side of learning. Right? It's really an education thing. It's a system piece. Right? And when you look at online learning, that's what you're seeing. A system that's been created to allow people to count what students are doing so that they can effectively bill back and get paid for it. That's to me where we're at. I mean, there's fantastic work being done all over the place. It just doesn't make it to the media because when the media is looking for somebody, they call MIT. in MIT are steeped in mastery learning. Like, they're all about things being true or not true and getting to the answer, right? The guy who built the edX platform was a computer guy who believes that things are true and false. I worked with him for 6 months. That's what they built. They built a mastery learning platform.
Mm. It's, I mean, there's a shade of horror across that in some ways. I mean, we've got this wonderful potential with the internet, some incredible connectivity, some yep. wonderful ways in which we can actually get people to learn and collaborate. And yet, as you say, the system that we put that into can actually just require just multiple choice answers towards some fairly non-imaginative assessment. So your vision then is so much broader than that, isn't it?
Well, I'll add some horror to your horror. That same online internet thingy that you're talking about is also where our democracy is playing out right now. And we have entire societies full of people who don't know how to handle it, right? They don't know how to handle the way they're being direct targeted on things like Facebook by mostly, partially, almost fake news that's leaning them towards one way of voting or another. We don't necessarily have a population that has been through enough to understand how they're being marketed to on a daily basis to buy things, right? So that communications platform is not something that we have built the social tools to deal with. Just a simple example. When we look at a classic academic paper and we look at the way that we cite it to make sure that the things are quote unquote true, right? You look at a simple, you know, APA citation. It's got like the publisher and the year and the author. Right. And for whatever reason that I've never understood, the city it was published in.
Yeah.
So you have these pieces that are markers of truth in a certain society. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it used to be that it was so expensive and complicated to actually print something that you could have some idea that a proper publishing company probably checked it before it went out. Yeah. Because it was such a big deal to go through the process. Right now, you and I can export a Word document to a website and have it published in 20 minutes, right? So that value of something having a publisher name on it really isn't, unless we have a list of trusted publishers that we all check, but that doesn't happen, right? So what we have is this proliferation of journals. We have a proliferation of publishing. We have an abundance of information out there. But all of our tools for tracking that abundance are scarcity-based. So the idea that we would ever have a citation now that doesn't have a link attached to it, to me, is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you send it to even the publisher's website? So somebody could identify whether that publisher is somebody that can be otherwise trusted.
Yeah.
But we've not made those adjustments in the work that we do yet. And we, as purveyors of knowledge, ostensibly, haven't made those adjustments. So how can we expect anybody else to have made it? I mean, that's our job, is to sort of talk about how knowledge works inside of our field and pass that on to somebody else. And we've not made those adjustments in our own practice. And so what we have in the last 5 or 6 years is we have corporations and we have governments and politicians and stuff who've discovered that they can use these tools in ways that they always have. And I'm not trying to throw politicians under the bus. I'm just saying that we have not updated ourselves. It shows in the way we do online learning. And I would say it not only behooves us to change the way we do learning face-to-face or online for the learning to be better.
Yeah.
I would say the stakes are higher. I think that our culture right now really needs a social contract for the internet, right? We really need to know what it is we're supposed to do. We need to do that work. And I think as people who work in the knowledge business, it's our responsibility, because who else is going to do it?
I'm just struck by the thought that our approach to the web is almost cobwebbed. There's a paradigm shift we all need to make in terms of our consideration of what knowledge is, where it comes from, how we apply it, but also how we expect students to engage with it.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So Dave, if I was to give you an unlimited budget, what research would you put that fund into? What do you most like to see? What most needs to happen in order to help take your vision forward?
I've always seen an inverse relationship between money and the value of the research that's come out of it.
Let me rephrase the question.
So,
I assume I'll give you nothing.
I assume I have nothing. Yeah, right. I would really like to see people tracking the way that interactions lead to truth. So, I mean, one of my favorite people, and he's going to be a recommendation for me in this, is Mike Caulfield, who does amazing work on identifying truth and information. And his four moves stuff in his book, to me, it's the go-to inside the field. And it's that, how did something come out to be true? And what is it that we can do to explain to other people how to be able to handle this? Mm-hmm. And it's not just about deciding whether or not you should vaccinate your kids. You should. Mm-hmm. But it's not just about being able to identify that. And we have a lot of those problems in our culture right now, where accepted scientific truths, accepted social processes are being broken down by specific corporations that are trying to break them down. But we have people who don't know how to identify and how to get down there for doing it. Then we have traditional organizations of trust who are now doing ad services for these groups as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we have the ad tech that's coming in as well. So I would love to be able to track how things become knowledge and see where the leverage points are, so that we can turn around and explain this to people, not just for our democracy, which is, you know, important, but also for how we make knowledge in the classroom. So what does the new academic paper look like, and how can it be based on how knowledge is actually created in our society now? Is that too crazy?
No, not at all. It's not what I was expecting, but that's great. So it's very much an epistemological focus. Now that we're in a 21st century mm-hmm. environment, now that the nature of access to knowledge has completely changed, how do we establish what truth is, or how do we come to a position that we can reasonably defend with the added security of knowing that it's well thought through and is a sound conclusion?
And how can we have that as a framework for the next generation, so that when we're handing on our approaches, we're not handing on our approaches of an information scarcity model, but rather an information abundance model?
I'm not sure how to return from that, actually, Dave. That's that's incredibly insightful. So, yeah, I can get a glimpse now as to why rhizomatic learning is so fundamental, because it does encourage that type of learning, doesn't it? That type of engagement with knowledge.
And it's the type of engagement with knowledge that we all do anyway. So when you learn how to cook, most of us didn't go to cooking class in grade one and learn how to hold a spoon and then learn how to hold a knife the next year and then learn what a carrot is the next year and graduate to knowing that you need to put the onions in before the garlic because onions cook slower than garlic does. Like, most of us didn't learn those things incrementally in a mastery model. We absorb this information as we go along. We add our own sort of taste to it. I add too much garlic to everything. Is that wrong? Well, not if you're me.
It's impossible.
But that's the way we see you and I, right? But that's the way we learn normally with everything else. It's how we learn to be friends. It's how we learn to drive. It's how we learn to do the things normally in our culture. And we have an education system that, due to a ton of bureaucratic necessities and some vile influences by a couple of people, has hardened itself to the point where it doesn't do that. And what I'm saying is that some of that bureaucratic necessity, a big chunk of that bureaucratic necessity, was actually the sort of tyranny of paper, right? Mm-hmm. Paper forces you to do a lot of things that we just take for granted, but when you work your way through them, it's not a terribly flexible medium. Granted, it doesn't break when you drop it on the floor, and that's nice. But it's slow, and it forces you to plan 6 months ahead, and it forces all these other pieces. It's necessarily linear. You know, there's all these sort of things that are built into paper that I think have caused a lot of that rigidity. What I'm saying is that we can let that go.
Well, Dave, just to round the time off, two people you'd recommend as leaders or legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you, one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share.
I think I'm going to go with Mike Caulfield. His work continues to influence me and keep me thinking about how important it is that we learn what the new model of knowledge is. So I think one of the things that I've learned from Mike Caulfield is the idea of choral definitions, that a definition is not something that exists in a book somewhere. It's something that is the culmination of a lot of people talking at the same time. And it doesn't become one thing, it stays choral. And I think, again, that is very much an abundant model of information, like in that abundancy model. Mm-hmm. The other one I think I'm going to say is Chris Gilliard, who does a lot of really great work on surveillance and how it impacts the education system. I think his voice is one that absolutely needs to be heard. He does a lot of really great work in that. And I think it's a message that that MIT model of what the internet and learning is about fails to recognize. Right. So I think his work is super important too. There's lots of other people I could mention, but them's my two picks.
Well, David, it's been a really fascinating interview. You've sort of zoomed out to take in the entire education system, but also zoomed in with some really interesting ways in which people can make a difference within their current teaching practice. Thank you so much. I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest in the links that we add to our website.
That's super kind of you to say. I hope you have a great day.
Brilliant. Thank you. You can learn more about Dave and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.